Welcome to the Blockchain DNA Podcast. This show brings you the latest in blockchain technology and global developments in business and fintech. Presented by Metaverse DNA.
DNA, the Metaverse Dual Chain Network Architecture.
Hi, I'm Alex Lightman. This is the Lightman Report. And today we're going to be talking about one of my favorite topics, payments, the past, present, and future of payments. So we've gone through big changes in the evolution of humanity, starting in ancient Egypt with the first paper money used by traders, cash. In ancient times, transactions, whether by consumer to consumer or consumer to business, were face-to-face, bartering physical goods. And cash has withstood the test of time and is the number one person-to-person, peer-to-peer instrument. In the first century BC, we had the first checks used by the Romans. And so they've been around for two millennia, and they've been used quite a lot for P2P transactions in the last 100 years. And most of the 20th century, checks were used by the wealthy. And in 1980s, checks scaled to become an important peer-to-peer tool. And check usage peaked in the 1990s at about 2.7 billion different check transactions. In cards, we had the first charge card introduced in 1914 by Western Union. And it's only been since the 50s that payment cards have been considered an acceptable payment tool. Cards have never been a significant peer-to-peer payment tool, primarily due to recipient acceptance challenges, unless it's a person-to-business. And new P2P innovations are bridging the card acceptance gap, and the volume of P2P transactions are on the rise. We had the first electronic movement of money. It was via telegraph in 1918. Digitization increased the size of the transaction, the speed of money flow of each transaction. And growth in online commerce has been a driver of online payment innovation and of P2P money transfers. So actually, electronic money movement had its 100th anniversary, its century, and we missed it. We didn't celebrate it. We should have. And PayPal has led to the online P2P innovation. And it was that $150 million from PayPal that invested, $110 million invested in Tesla and $40 million in SpaceX has led to Elon Musk being worth $48 billion. And M-Payments, we had the first mobile payment offered by SMS in Finland to vending machines in 1997. So that's a 23-year-old technology. And early innovation in mobile has come from developing nations where the majority of the people are unbanked. There's a big connection between the unbanked, and as we'll see, that's 2 billion adults. 31% of all adults are unbanked. And mobile phones and mobile money. So companies, or projects rather, like M-Pesa, which is a part of the company Safaricom, have facilitated P2P money movement via stored value credit. And recently, banks and technology companies have been investing in P2P propositions that drive mobile as the instrument of choice over the coming years. So going back to the past, we went from bartering and livestock to the first coins. Bartering was an advantageous way to exchange goods and services for people many years ago because it enabled both parties to get what they needed. For example, two parties might exchange tools for services to fulfill the needs of both people. And livestock was also considered wealth that people could amass. The more cows or sheep someone owned, the wealthier they were. Ancient civilizations used to use beads and shells as coins. Eventually, they used precious metals to make coins more durable. And people in ancient civilizations of Lydia were among the first to use coins made of gold and silver. This currency was both valuable and portable. So we had bartering in prehistory. Early man would barter their goods and service they had for the ones they lacked. 1200 BC, they had cowrie shells. Cowrie shells was the dominant form of money in Asia. China was the first to use them, big innovation there. And about 1000 to 700 BC, we had metal coins. Coins made from base metal first appeared in China, 1000 to 600 BC, and gold coins were first used in Lydia. So we have China actually with the first to use shells, the first to use metal coins, and one of the first to use paper money. Pretty impressive. So the past, benefits of money against barter. the value can be retained, even if partially, rather than complete decay. And there's an ease of transfer of value and to defer value. Durability, you can withstand repeated use. You have that with coins, paper, gold. Portability, you can carry it around. Divisibility, fractional units. Uniformity, versions of the same currency have identical value. Limited supply, unlimited supply equals zero value. And that's the big innovation of cryptocurrency to solve the double spend problem, to solve the problem of unlimited supply leading to hyperinflation, leading to collapse. And then acceptability. This is legal tender for all debts, public and private, written on the currency. And stability. If it's unstable, people will look for alternatives. And so we have in 600 BC, the first official currency was minted by King Aliates of Lydia in modern, where Turkey is today. And we also had in 1290 AD, the travels of Marco Polo to China introduced the idea of paper money to Europeans. In 1250 AD, the florin, the gold coin minted in florin, was widely accepted, encouraging international commerce. And you had in 1661, paper money didn't catch on for quite a while because you didn't have the first banknotes being printed until, basically 400 years approximately from the time that Marco Polo came back again. And in 1860, you had industrial giants like Western Union spearheading e-money with electronic funds transfer. And then in 1946, John Biggins invented the charge-it card, the first credit card. So if you look at that show, one of the greatest shows in the history of television was Silicon Valley by Mike Judge, and Aristotle's sound money is cited in the Silicon Valley episode on the Pied Piper coin when they were getting into crypto. So the properties of sound money are durability, physically stable, does not rot or rust or melt, transferable, easy to transfer ownership from one person to another, divisible, can be subdivided into smaller units of money, scarce, limited quantity available for use, recognizable, easy to recognize and verify authenticity, and fungible, one unit of money can be substituted for another. Present, that digitization of payments and money transfers. So we've gone from the past, now we're coming to the present. Internet banking is spread across the US in the 1990s, pay by touch, 2002. Bitcoin is the first digital money that solved the double spend problem starting in January 3rd, 2009. The white paper came out Halloween 2008. The last 5 years, banks started closing their office and transferred to remote banking. Look up the books by Brett King. I'm his co-author of the book Augmented Life in the Smart Lane. Brett has written books, Bank 3.0, Bank 4.0, Best Business Book of the Year, according to some people, Branch Today, Gone Tomorrow, books about this whole phenomenon, if you want to dive into it. And Apple Pay was launched in 2014. Smart payments started to be available. Google Pay, 2015. Samsung Pay, 2015. And we have a lot of news about cash. So one of the main disadvantages of paper cash is that it can transfer viruses, including the dreaded coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2. And hence, digital payments and crypto are healthier alternatives. So in Russia, Russians were urged to reject cash to slow the coronavirus spread. And there are many, many headlines saying we're going to decline that. Yes, there probably is some level of people who want to control electronic money behind this, but it's also factual. In the future, private money, to be or not to be, or B2B, corporations are trying to create their own payment ecosystems. The future was bright until it wasn't. And as we've seen in a previous Lightman report on the challenges of digital assets, the government stopped the launch of Libra, Facebook, and of Gram from the, from the Telegram network. And corporations will continue to entertain the idea of issuing private money to facilitate payments and more, especially in the time of global crisis. And the Chinese government has launched a pilot project for the digital yuan. And since there are 150,000 companies that are majority owned or substantially owned or controlled by the Chinese government, they can create an ecosystem overnight for the digital yuan, like that. And the first companies using it include McDonald's and Starbucks. So the COVID-19 crisis is the crisis of global order, and conflicts between the U.S. and China might end up dividing the world in separate economic zones. So you might have one part of Asia that's all digital yuan-based, another that's all dollar-based. And it's possible that the fight between the digital yuan and the digital dollar will be part of the confrontation between the U.S. and China for economic supremacy during the 2020 to 2030 period. And then we're getting to something I really love to talk about, which is the smartphone as the main payment system. So we spend our hours of our free time on our 4 billion smartphones, and mobile banking already is available for billions of people. E-commerce is evolving into m-commerce. That was the very first Lightman report, how that was working, how you were having physical world retail go to e-commerce and m-commerce. And banking and merchants, as we know them, might go extinct and be replaced by smartphone apps. So let's dive into some of these stats here. The global value of payment technologies market is about just around $3 trillion, with an annual growth rate of just around 38%. In the top five countries with mobile wallet usage, these are the smart countries: China with 47%, Norway with 42%, the UK with 24%, Japan with 20%, Australia 19%. America, come on, everyone should be using mobile wallets. And you have four types of payment technology: near field communication, sound wave based, secure magnetic transmission, and QR code. Mobile spending by segment. By far the largest percentage of it, about 69%, is money transfers. And then 23% is for merchandise purchases, for bill payments 5.1%, for ticketing about 1%, and everything else is less than 2%. So it's all about the money transfers. And worldwide users per mobile wallet, by far the greatest number are using WeChat Pay, 600 million, Alipay, 400 million. So of the top payment system, China has a billion people out of 8 billion people using their mobile wallets. That's incredible. They're way ahead of everybody else. PayPal, 210 million. Apple Pay, 87 million. I'm surprised. I thought it would be more. Samsung Pay, 34 million. Amazon Pay, 33 million. Now, Amazon has about 300 million regular customers, so that's only about 10% of their customers. I think that you'll see some of the fastest growth there. And then you have the future of mobile payments. You will get rid of physical cards. You'll have wearables. I just got my Fitbit working since last night. We can switch the camera to me. There, see, that's my new Fitbit. And then also biometric technology. And this Fitbit has all kinds of biometrics, and it has payment. So both of those are integrated in together. Now, there are 12 disruptive technologies that are going to impact payments in a big way. And this has been around for a while. This was created in 2013 by Daniel Tay in Singapore, and McKinsey and Company put it out there. So renewable energy, people will want to have crypto to get payments from individual solar panels, and advanced oil and gas exploration and recovery, advanced materials, 3D printing, energy storage, next generation genomics, autonomous and near autonomous vehicles will use payments. So you'll have Ubers that have no driver, where the vehicle will be going out and trying to pick up passengers and earn more money, and then trade that money to be charged up in electricity portals that are all around. Advanced robotics, cloud technology, the Internet of Things, automation of knowledge work, and the mobile internet. All these things will impact payments in a big way, because it's not just people, but it's also machines that will be using that. There's something called the Dictionary of the Future, and it quotes me with the term, or credits me with the term, internet iceberg effect, and that what you see in the internet, where it's human to human, that's just the tip of the iceberg, because 90% of what's happening in the internet is machine to machine, not person to person. And the future of payments, we're gonna have less cash. So cash is basically falling below 40%, killing the credit card through near field communication, getting a single number that you can switch around, at less store-based payments, and wallets become virtual. And PIN numbers are, you don't have to use them for transactions. They're less and less used, and no currency borders. And I'm gonna read this one. Bitcoin and other virtual currencies offer instant, cheap, and secure ways to pay, and have gained traction despite concerns surrounding illegal activity and tax avoidance. Some economists foresee them being used as tools to help stimulate, complement, and entirely replace existing border-based currencies. And in the future, We have KYC and regulations. Today, every financial provider operates in a single jurisdiction that has its own regulation and own Know Your Customer policy. These issues need a complex regulatory approach by governments and international organizations. Regulators can create a common database for KYC and open access to financial providers. And in this situation, the sponsors of this program, Metaverse and DNA Chain, can be useful for KYC standards for the financial industry. So let's talk about crypto payments for the unbanked and for the banked. 2 billion adults don't have bank accounts. That's 31% of all adults. Cryptocurrency could change their lives because many of these people do have mobile phones. Large numbers of the unbanked live in developing nations where their capital is unprotected, and they often live in under oppressive regimes that manipulate local currencies through taxation, inflation, theft, and so on. Crypto is the only truly global currency, free from any one entity's influence. Without complex banking corrupt bureaucracies, cryptocurrencies give the unbanked the chance to securely save and transfer money, access credit, and even make international transfers. Have you read about what's happening in Venezuela? And I'll just tell you one thing. The salary in Venezuela, if you translate it from bolivars, is about $6 a month. You know how much it costs in Venezuela for a hamburger or a hot dog? $2. So this is where a lot of people have maintained their buying power in the face of the collapse of the buying power of their salaries. And then the implications of crypto for the banked. As public distrust of our financial institution increases, so does the demand for a more open, transparent credit system. And banks exploit us by charging deposit and withdrawal fees, foreign transaction fees, lost card fees, membership and service fees, overdraft fees. By the way, there are people who have sent hundreds of millions of dollars in crypto for less than the cost of an overdraft. Does that make any sense? ATM fees, account closing fees, and many more. And cryptocurrency, in theory, has no middlemen to charge transaction tolls. Say you need cash to get across a border. Who would you trust your local teller to deliver it in a few business days, working banker's hours? Or would you trust the most secure and sophisticated digital distribution highway ever created? There's never been a cheaper and faster channel to send and receive funds than crypto. There's big implications for crypto payments for e-commerce and m-commerce. Today's online payment infrastructure allows mega corporations to collect data on our purchases, but you don't have to give them that. All transactions on the blockchain are snarky and therefore pseudonymous. And decentralized apps will be unable to monitor user activity other than basic non-identifying metrics to keep their system stable. Users will be able to verify the validity of a transaction on their own without being serfs of big techs or their banks. So, last slide, the future of AI-enabled payments is coming. So right now, 25% of transactions are manually reviewed. There are 726 global payment processing this year. You'll have 726 billion transactions. And there are 6 use cases for AI-enabled payments. AI-based chatbots that interact with customers, answering questions or directing them. Improved fraud detection, the AI can analyze data to look for unexpected commonalities between fraudulent and non-fraudulent transactions. Biometric payments, AI systems can use facial and voice recognition to enable payments without needing a card. AI-based credit scores, AI offers lenders the ability to get a hyper-personalized look at someone's creditworthiness and score them more accurately. You can have AI and debit cards that can help consumers reduce student loans or credit card debt and make better spending and savings. Brett King has a company called Moovin that actually gives you feedback on your payments and how that works. And digital payment wallets. AI and a collaboration of digital payment wallets with other online services like Messengers helps users make peer-to-peer payments via Facebook Messenger or Slack or other things. So that's our Lightman Report this week on the past, present, and future of payments. I hope you've enjoyed it, and I hope that as you make transactions that you'll save more money and you'll be able to do more things based on what you might have learned here. Thank you for your time, and I hope to see you again in a future Lightman Report.
Like what you hear so far? Make sure you never miss a show by clicking the subscribe button now. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Now, back to the show.
Good evening, everybody. I would like to welcome you to the interview over the Lightman Report on payments, one of the most vital elements to our economic traffic back in the old days, in history, today, but even in the future, as it will always be part of our lives. Eric, Alex, welcome to this interview. We had a lot of face-to-face transactions in the past, you know, from exchanging goods to involving currencies, and then we evolved into the banking systems, but that's more distant. So how do we look towards your future of face-to-face in the digital space? Because we're going back to a peer-to-peer situation where the intermediate is not there anymore. So how has this changed? How will it change in the future? Eric, maybe you can put some light into that, how you see that.
It's interesting that I think this is the first time that we could use face-to-face that has no intermediary, right? It's like just a cash system, right? It's very interesting. Unlike before, we always use bank or some sort of other intermediate. I think in the future, face-to-face transaction will be more and more interesting. Think about this. It might not be two human beings. It could be human being and machine, a machine to machine. And it may not use the cash we're seeing right now. It could be, it will be a digital form of payment. And this digital form of payment has no centralized clearing system. That would be very, very interesting.
So what you're actually saying, Eric, that we go into a situation where the word face will get a new definition in the digital space.
Right. The face will be a very different thing. When you say face, actually make me think of many, many other things. Nowadays, we have facial recognition, a lot of other new technologies, yes. Right? So why do we even need a credit card? Right, your face recognition actually linked to your digital identity. That digital identity gives you a credit score, and you don't have to pay on cash. You can pay on credit. That credit actually linked to the face. That's another thought. Okay.
I think you know what is around the corner. We do have extensive facial recognition systems that already work very good. We started with the eye, the iris scan. You know, that we've known for a couple of years already, biorhythmic recognition. So it would actually mean that our real face, our biological face, was recognized, but it's protected by what we would call our digital face, which is actually guaranteeing our privacy, but not damaging anything of the trust. Is that where you're thinking, where you thought?
Yeah, so when you say face, it could be our digital face, meaning digital identity. And I think in the last few episodes, we actually talked about digital identities. For every human being, we can have multiple identities and multiple ways of paying or, holding assets or payment could be different.
Alex, if you hear Eric sort of engaging into what it is now and where it's going in the future, do you see the same sort of development? Because I think we already have all these technologies. It's just the combination is not there for the consumer right now.
Well, I think it's worth pointing out that this area of payments is very exciting. I once read a study which was somebody was trying to find what is the easiest way to make an internet company worth $1 billion or more, to make a unicorn. And the answer was payments. And so we can say, why are payments so great? And the answer is because it's something where that before this face-to-face, needing to trust somebody to make a deal with them was so important. And so we have kind of a backlog of all these people who want to buy, sell, borrow, loan, and swap from all over the world. And the ability to have a good, reliable payment system so that anybody can buy from anybody else, sell to anybody else, borrow from anyone else, loan, swap things back and forth. And the fact that you can have currency, equities, bonds, real estate, consumer products, travel, tourism, all this, it just opens up the market for all kinds of new payment systems. And yes, Eric, of course, is spot on. Eric's emphasis has been, in many cases, on the right thing, which is identity. So if you know, you have to know who somebody is, and also the ability, we had a past Lightman report on verifiable pseudonyms, which is very important because you don't necessarily want everyone to know all of your business for a variety of reasons. And so now as we get to payments, people who can allow you to, on the one hand, have your credit and your trustworthiness and do that, but also keep your privacy, there's all kinds of different opportunities for them. And investors love things that have high margins. They love things where you can make a deal and you have no cost of the underlying goods. So if you're a payment system provider, you don't have to pay for the underlying cost of goods. You don't have to pay for oil to be found and drilled and the scans and the refining and all that. You just get your tiny cut. Another thing is that it's very scalable because typically payments will be a percentage of something. Like getting 1% on trillions of dollars is a pretty darn good business model.
Yes.
And finally, there's the ability to have that data on what people are buying and what they're selling, because then you can use that to offer them similar products. Like one of the most simple things that was done, the thing that made it almost inevitable that Jeff Bezos would become the richest person in the world, is when he implemented that system that said, people who bought this book also bought that book. Like that one thing creates a viral loop within the payments thing. And then the other thing, combining that with that patent on one-click payment. So anybody who can take the steps out, take the friction out to do that. And if you look at Google, it's a trillion-dollar valuation for something that's a ham-fisted way to buy things. You type in the name, you get a list, you know, go to that place, you screw around within it. And so what's great about payments is there's still room to do amazing things with it. And probably there's another 20 or so unicorns to be made within payments.
I think if you, couple of the items that you just mentioned, they've got one thing in common, and that's mass adoption. All of these systems that were successful as a unicorn had some type of mass adoption. So I think trust, acceptability is one of the main reasons. Why do you buy that other book? Because you trust the fact that lots of other people that bought your book that you just purchased also were interested in this, that, and so on. So the acceptability in digital transactions, in some way, I would say it's a referral. It's a way of being comfortable with something that's being presented to you. Eric, what do you think are the best ways towards the future to put more ease in the public where it comes to digital transactions, payments, especially made towards the future? What would be a good way to put the public at ease? Because mass adoption is the goal for all of these new unicorns. And I think the three of us are united on one thing, that this type of payment is definitely going to be in some shape or sort of form in the future.
Well, trust and adaptation will never come just overnight. It will take time, as mm-hmm. always. But the good thing is we as consumer, or say we as people, start to trust technology slowly. We start to trust all kinds of technologies. Mm-hmm. I think it's pretty hard to ask the ancient people to get on an airplane. They wouldn't trust that technology, right? Or anyone.
They wouldn't even trust an automatic staircase in a warehouse when they first were.
Exactly. So we kind of start to trust technology, right? So we wouldn't be scared to say, oh, SpaceX is going to send people to the space because, oh, this is like disaster. No, it's not. People start to trust that. So slowly, people building trust into technology. We in our industry, we have a joke. We say, instead of saying in God we trust, we say in crypto we trust. So we trust cryptography, right?
That's our new t-shirt, guys. In crypto, we trust.
Yes, we say in crypto, we trust. So we know that there's no way, mathematically impossible to break some of the cryptographies, right? So we trust that kind of piece of mathematics, also technology. So we trust that nobody gonna steal my money or nobody gonna hack into my system because I trust this piece of cryptography. So that's the trust. So the financial trust come later. I think the trust in current financial system is like trust in people, in organization. So in a system that built by the organization. Now, we kind of ask these consumers or say investors to shift their trust into the system that built of machine or cryptography. So, but this kind of setup already there, I think. We're already there. So it will be relatively quicker than we thought. That's
Alex, I think. In one of your past LIMA reports, we discussed the tremendous, I would say, increase in speed of digital economy based upon the recent pandemic and all the developments that sort of snowballed from that.
That was in the first one.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, in a way that we're 30 years up front of what we thought in January where we would be, what we believe to be there in 2030 or 2050 is around the corner or already there. So if we go to acceptability, how do you think it was possible for people to go so fast into this new development? Because it's a way of, I would say, trust of the public that's increased in this type of business. Is it just a pandemic, or do you think there are other reasons that people stepped into this?
Well, there are different reasons at different stages. So I remember that the television was filled with massive advertising for e-commerce sites like pets.com had an enormous number of ads for the sock puppet and all that. And it was a massive transfer of venture capital into television advertising. So there were dot bombs that no longer are with us that bought $1 million ads on the Super Bowl for 15 seconds and 30 seconds. And so part of that was there. And I remember going and speaking. I was a keynote speaker with John Sculley, the former CEO of Apple, at Internet World in New Delhi in 2000. And I remember there were only a few million people on the internet in all of India. And every city I went to in India, there were billboards or flags that somebody had gone up for different e-commerce sites. So I think that basically it's just that they spent so much money. Lately, it's because so much money has been thrown at it from Wall Street. So you have things like, you have Amazon as one of the most valuable companies in the world, one of that rare trillion-dollar.
Alex, we lost your camera there. Oh, you're back.
Sorry,
again.
Taylor just called me. There was this massive explosion of publicity around Amazon, and Amazon has more than 20 million products. Now, in New York or in LA, there are over 1 billion SKUs, stock keeping units, a billion different products. So Amazon does not have all products available in a big city by any means. It's only got a tiny fraction, but still, to be able to use your mobile phone to choose any of 20 million products, get one-click shopping, have free delivery, and for the same price of that Amazon Prime, get thousands of movies, thousands of TV shows, thousands of songs, this kind of all-you-can-eat simplification, so it's all there. One price gets you so much. It's kind of an irresistible offer. And then you have Shopify that has become worth tens of billions of dollars. I didn't check it, but it's I've heard $100 billion just for Shopify. So this is something that in a $382 trillion, you know, world, like if you look at the total value of all the things in the world, is that an $82 trillion from last year, then payments and the ability to facilitate transactions is the sharp point of the spear and growing faster than the GDP, faster than any currency, because it's the double exponential. Like you have the first derivative of distance with respect to time is velocity, and the second derivative is acceleration. You know, you also have this, like a later one, the derivative of the derivative is that is jerk. Like that's an acceleration of acceleration. So it's like the jerk of money, the jerk of GDP.
To close it off, this fascinating, I mean, we will talk a lot more about payments in the coming year. It's a vital, I would say, development area for cryptocurrencies. In some ways, digital cryptocurrencies are more stable than a lot of fiat currencies worldwide. Still, people think about the volatility. I mean, there's no Ministry of Finance manipulating things. There's no, you know, Fed. There's no Frankfurt manipulating it, or at least we hope they don't. But in a way, how do you see that we could control this volatility that people still, you know, I would say the average person thinks because of all the news about Bitcoin or whatever, that, you know, the rate of cryptocurrency goes up and down like wild and it's completely uncontrollable and blah, 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 and you run a lot of risk. How do you see that we could control this volatility better, Eric, to have more mass adoption in the, I would say, in the follow-up of what Alex just explained as digital economy's largest expansion at the moment?
I think my answer is you don't. You don't control the volatility. But the good news is for the past weeks, right? If you look week over weeks, the volatility of Bitcoin is pretty low at this moment. But it has no guarantee for the future. But if you look like for the past 12 months, Bitcoin went up like 300% or more, right? So it's still, you still can call it very volatile. But my answer to you is don't control the volatility. Let it be stable coin. So you will have stable coin and Bitcoin. So if you want to invest, so it's an asset class. Bitcoin is an asset class. But if you really want to use it, use a stable coin. Why? I can tell you. I think 3-4 years ago, I spent about 8 Bitcoin just to get on a cruise ship. Look back, that's very expensive, right?
So I would say yes, it is.
Yeah, so the lesson is don't spend your Bitcoin on this. You spend stablecoin instead, right? So I think maybe 10 years from now, you look at this 8 Bitcoins. Eric, you're crazy, you spent 8 Bitcoin on cruise ship. But back then it was like only $500, right? So even less than $500, 8 of them for a whole family vacation, that's reasonable. But now, no, it's not. So my answer is don't control the volatility, but when you want to spend money, spend stable coin. And I believe there will be a huge wave of other type of stable coin very soon. It's on the horizon. It's coming. Yeah, we're here.
I want to thank you both, Alex and Eric, for commenting on our payments Lightman report. I think we will talk much more in the future about stablecoins and payments because it's a very fast evolving industry. I'm looking forward already to the next type of Lightman reports in this section because payments is one of the key elements in the development of new economy. I want to thank you both and I'll see you next week. No doubt about it. Until a very next topic that Alex is going to talk about. Thank you both. Bye, Eric. Bye, Alex.
Bye, Annamika. Bye, Eric. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us this week on the Blockchain DNA podcast. Make sure to visit our website and follow us on social media at DNA by Metaverse or at MBS DNA. Till next time.